And the title for this evening's talk was, well, actually I remember now, was given to me in an email during the week. It was a very, sometimes people give suggestions and they're just, you know, pretty sort of hopeless. Some are very good. Hopeless means you can't really give a talk about that. It's either too technical or it's too obscure. But it was a very good subject which they asked, what do you do? How do you deal with the suffering of someone you love? When someone you love very dearly is going through a difficult or hard time. As a Buddhist, how do we deal with that? Because many times here I've told you how you deal with your own suffering and with your own difficulties in life, but now it's actually how we deal with somebody else's. And of course we always have people we care about, we love, and from time to time they go through some terrible situations and difficulties. And you need to know some skillful means and responses and how to deal with that. Otherwise, it starts off with one person suffering, and then there's two, and then there's three, and there's a whole family, and there's a whole community, and the whole world is suffering, and that's not going to help anybody. So it's an interesting question, and there's some very deep answers to that question, which illustrate just a different way in which Buddhists can actually view these things. So first of all, when we say that when someone we love is suffering, why do we suffer as well? It's a great question there, because sure enough that we have love, but does love really have to mean that when somebody suffers that we suffer as well? Is that the real meaning of love? I know that sometimes that if you are a wise person who has Buddhist love, and someone else is suffering and you don't go crazy, sometimes people think you're cold, you're callous. But that's actually not the case. In many situations, I've seen families where someone is suffering badly and then another person, a Buddhist member of their family, is very peaceful and calm. And they give a huge benefit to the family. They give another option. When somebody else is suffering, you don't need to suffer as well. But let's go back a little bit. Why does that happen anyway? And I think why it happens is because in most people, what they think is love is not real love. It's more like what we call in Buddhism an attachment. And by an attachment, what I really mean by that can be illustrated by an experience which I had during the week. Every year I give a talk at Curtin University on the series of talks on human rights and the different religions, and I always do the Buddhism and human rights talk. And when I was talking about the freedom, say, of children to choose their religion and the path in life, some of the students who were from Kenya, who really didn't have much experience of Buddhism, let alone just, you know, some of the ideas which have been developed in Western countries like Australia over many years, they said, no, no, if you really love your children, you should actually give them a religion, teach them everything. And is that really love? How can you love your child and not do the best for them? And I mentioned to them that that type of love which you're describing is like a love of control, as if you own your child. And that's something which is very clear in Buddhism, especially in our monastic system, that we realize we don't own anything. And the idea of that you owning your children could be compared to many years ago when your husband owned you if you were the wife. And how did that feel? Fortunately, we've actually progressed from that state in Australia. You know, husbands don't own you. You're not chattels anymore. Now imagine what your children must feel if you think you own them. In Buddhism, we never think that's my child. If it's my child, then with that my comes ownership, and with ownership comes control. And with control, we really think we're doing the very, very best for our child, and we control them so much without really much input from them, that we usually can very easily harm our kids. It is not my son. It is not my daughter. In Buddhism, we realize this being has come into your life, and it's not just come from the combination, you know, of your genes. This comes with a personality, with a history, and I've never been a mother, but I've asked many Buddhist mothers and non-Buddhist mothers, and when that child first comes out and they bond with that child, that so many mothers know that this is something with a personality. This is a being with a history which goes way beyond, you know, the time in my womb. He has a character. And of course, I love all these great stories which I've accumulated, because I accumulate weird stories. One person, I think it's, if I remember correctly, a few years ago, from here in Perth, told me that when their child was born, I think they were still in the hospital, and they just breastfed their kid, so they're laying on their back in the hospital bed, and the child had just finished breastfeeding, and took his mouth, or her mouth, forget which, away from the breast, and then just sat on her mother's tummy, crossed her legs, his legs in full lotus, put one hand over the other, and assumed a meditation posture. And that spooked the woman out. My goodness, here was a baby who knew how to sit meditation. And it just came out of the tummy, out of the womb. And this, so it shows that these children who come into your life, they have a history. Now, it's not their first life, it's reincarnation, for goodness sake. And I know that sometimes there was a program on ABC and somebody gave me a printout of it. You know, some sort of person who sort of claims to be a Buddhist but is not a Buddhist at all and claims to be a scholar, doesn't know anything about what the Buddha actually said, it seems. Now, very clearly the Buddha actually taught reincarnation. I can quote you the suttas very clearly, no ambiguity at all. Original Buddhism was all about reincarnation and many other things as well. Okay, if you don't believe it, fine. But please don't say the Buddha never taught reincarnation, because it's very certain that he did. And it's a wonderful thing to actually accept. There is evidence there. I can quote you the evidence, scientific evidence. Anyone who wants to read it, that's Ian Stevenson. Get on Google, get all the stuff from there. And there's other stuff being sort of come later on from people like Professor Pim van Lommel, but that's another talk altogether. But accepting reincarnation, at least there's a possibility, means this being comes into your life. And it's come from another place, another life. It comes with history. So is it really your child? Does it belong to you? Or is it this being which is entrusted into your care for so many years? If you really think it's your child, with ownership, it's like property. If it's your property, it's you to do with as you wish. If you own your car, you can actually gun the engine and abuse it. It's your car, it's your freedom to do that, as long as you don't harm anybody else, because it's yours. Now, if it's your sort of house, if you want to wreck it, you know, that's your problem, as long as it doesn't affect the neighbours next door. Whatever is yours, you know, you have ownership over, and therefore you have rights, whatever you want to do with it, basically. It is yours. Your money, if it's yours, you can spend it however you like. If it's your child, this is that ownership gives us the perception of control. And that is where a lot of child abuse starts from. Instead of actually looking upon it as ours to control, to mold, if we look upon it as something which is put into our care, which comes from a history, we've got to care for it, nurture it, but not control it, then the whole ball game of bringing up a child is very, very different. And a good example of this is, you know, with something like the choice of religion. Because as Buddhism comes into the Western world and gets stronger and stronger with every year, there are many people actually who are, you know, Westerners, Caucasians, with no connection at all with any traditional form of Buddhism, and then they have a child, and then obviously you want to nurture the child to the very best for your child, because that's part of the real love, not owning, but caring for it. How do you bring it up? Especially with religion. What religion should you impose upon your child? Or not impose any religion? Or impose all religions? What the heck should you do? And this question was once asked of a monk in England many years ago. And the answer he gave was actually very beautiful. He said, don't bring your child up as a Buddhist. That's controlling them. That's imposing your views on your kid. Don't bring them up with no religion, just thinking that just leave them alone. Don't bring them up exposed to all religions. That's not the point. He said, instead, encourage your child in two qualities. Encourage your child always to question, always to ask those questions, and never to take for granted just what other people tell you. Because you know that sometimes, actually not sometimes, very often, when we believe what other people tell us, we get into big trouble. Much of your life is just believing what other people have told you, and later on in your life finding it was all wrong. You know, and that causes a lot of suffering. So don't just believe what other people tell you. Question, and question, and question. That is basically the scientific method. That's the way we arrive at truth. But, he said, as well as questioning, encourage your child to be honest. So honest that they respect truth so much that in their questioning they will never stop, you know, if they haven't got an answer which is satisfactory, which is dishonest. Dishonest to their experience, dishonest to themselves, dishonest to life. So keep on questioning and have that sense of honesty of what's really right, what's really true. And if you encourage your child with those two qualities, questioning and honesty, they will have the tools to find out their own religion. And if Buddhism is worth its being a religion, then it should be subject to questioning. It should be subject to that honesty. And the same with all other religions. You shouldn't just believe because I tell you to. You shouldn't just believe because if you don't, you'll all go to hell. You shouldn't just believe because, you know, there's a financial benefit for doing so. If there should be sort of some honesty there, some truthfulness and ability to question and question and question, and then maybe take it on board. You see, if you teach your child like that, that's what we call caring for them. You're empowering them rather than telling them. You're generating these qualities in them rather than, again, controlling them. Now that's exactly the same in any other relationship. If it's someone you love, we call it an attachment. If you think that's my wife, that's my husband, that's my partner, that's my father, that's my mother. If you think like that, then that attachment there is a sense of ownership. And with that sense of ownership, there will always be a little bit of control. Sometimes that just as a slip of the tongue or just because I know no other word, I say my monastery down at Serpentine, my monks. They're not my monks. They haven't signed their life over to me. They haven't taken vows of obedience. Sometimes I wish they would. But no. They argue with me, I argue with them. We ask questions until we can both all come to a sort of a common conclusion. But there is no sense of ownership. As soon as you have some sense of ownership, that is where the suffering comes. When somebody you love suffers. Now, I'm going to give a little example and I'm going to extend it. First of all, somebody you love. There was one man who used to come here. He didn't have a partner. He didn't have a family. But he had one thing he really, really loved, and that was his motorbike, a Harley Davidson. That was the one thing in his life he loved and cherished. And he wrote to me one day that he was over in Sydney. He was doing some shopping in a shopping mall. He parked his Harley in a multi-story car park. And when he finished his shopping and he went back, someone had stolen it. The only thing in his life which he loved and cared for, his Harley, had gone. Now he had come here many times. He had learned all these teachings. He knew about attachment. What love really means is you can love something, but when it goes, when it dies, when it gets stolen, you can let it go. And that is what real love is. Love is when you can care and enjoy your Harley, and when it crashes or it gets stolen, you can let it go. And he wrote back to me because he said he did it. He looked at that empty space where he parked his Harley, realized it was stolen, and it was okay. He could let it go. He never suffered because his Harley had been taken away. And he was so proud of himself. I'm a real Buddhist. I don't get upset when I lose the most expensive and valuable, the only thing I love in the world. I've let it go. And he was so proud of himself, but then he laughed at himself. Because then he realized that he was in the wrong bay, in the car park. He was actually in the wrong level. He went down to the real level and there was his Harley Davidson still parked there. So he said, I won both ways that way. You know, I had my test and I passed the test, but I also had my Harley afterwards. Now what a wonderful story that is. What about you? Could you do that? Or would you suffer when someone you love dies? Now a real Buddhist, someone who understands love, would realize that when someone you've been with for a long, long time is about to pass on to a new life, why get upset at them? Why do you suffer? You will find that if you have real grief and suffering when somebody dies, it means because there's a sense of ownership on there. It's my wife, it's my husband, it's my son. Because would you die? Would you suffer when somebody else's husband dies? Not to the same extent. When somebody else's child? Not to the same extent. When it's my child, that's when the suffering is really very strong. It all comes from this sense of my and ownership. When we learn how to love properly, we care for each other without this sense of owning. Which means that when you have a relationship with your child, with your parents, with your partner, or even with yourself, it becomes a very beautiful, freeing relationship. Now I mention this because many of you have your partners in life, and many of you have gone through relationships already where you have felt that you are owned and controlled, and of course that relationship just is terrible to be in, and eventually just fades away. And you have other relationships where you meet someone and there's not a sense that this guy or this girl is actually owning me or controlling me. It gives me freedom, it gives me trust. And that type of relationship is what we recognize as real love. A love which will free us. The same with, say, me becoming a monk. My father was dead, my mother was very much alive. When I asked her, can I become a monk? She said, I haven't got a clue what you're doing, but if that's what you want to do, do it. It was a beautiful sense of a parent loving their child. It was not controlling them, but understanding that they were caring for them, they respected their child's choice. Simply, they opened the door of their heart and said, child, wherever you want to go, whatever you want to do, the door of my heart's always open to you. Go on, try it. Because if we don't do that, I gave the simile many times. It's like putting your child, putting your partner, putting your parents in a cage, telling them what to do, not giving them any freedom. And you find if you put someone in a cage like that, like putting a bird in a cage, sooner or later the door is going to be left open, by accident usually, and the bird flies away and will never come back home again. I've seen parents like that controlling their kids so much, they never come home again once they leave. I've seen other parents who show their kids this sense of trust and freedom. It's just like having a bird and leaving the cage open. But you know, it's a nice cage. You've got some nice food in there, a nice place to sleep, and whatever else a bird wants in the cage, but a nice mirror to look at. I had a budgie when I was very young. You know, it's interesting. I was so smart when I was very young, because one day the budgie disappeared. And I said, where's the budgie, Daddy? And Daddy said, oh, he's gone on holiday. I said, no, he's not. He's died, hasn't he? Yeah, I sussed out my dad pretty quickly. I said, don't lie to me, Dad. He's died. That's okay. I was only about 4 or 5 years old, but I still remember that. But anyhow, So if you put a bird in a cage and leave the door open, but it's a nice cage, yeah, the bird flies away, but always comes home again. You know, I'm actually very happy with the monastery at Bodhinyana. I was about to say my monastery, but I'm going to be very careful this evening. We have many monks there, and some monks make it, they become monks, and they stay as monks many years, and they go overseas. Some monks, you know, they come here, and they stay for a few years, and they just throw, but they get married, but they still keep coming, hanging around our monastery. I'm actually very happy about that, because if a person became a monk, and as soon as they left, they said, I'm never going to come back here again, what a terrible place, and I never saw them again, I'd be very worried about the whole ethos of Bodhinyana Monastery down at Serpentine. But they don't do that, they keep coming back. Even Simon was here this evening, he's probably still here, out the back there somewhere. And all the other monks who are monks, they keep coming and hanging around and helping around. So I'm very pleased about that. We've set them free. Yeah, you can disrobe if you want to, but they keep coming back again. And that's brilliant. It means that there's a sense of you've given them freedom, you've given them trust, you've given them love, and it's okay. Same would be wonderful if once you get divorced from a partner. It wouldn't be that you were afraid to see them again. You saw them in a shopping mall, you had to sort of duck into sort of the toilets or something so you wouldn't see them. Here comes my ex, oh my God. No, there's a sense of sort of freedom there and friendship and being at ease. Now, real love is like that. It always has a sense of trust as well. So if it really is someone you love and they're suffering, you won't try and control them. You won't need to say, just, I can't stand that, just get out of that suffering. Because we all know that suffering, yeah, it's painful, but it's very important as well. Suffering is what we call the growing pains of life. In the same way that if you had a child and you're always protecting it from all these diseases, everyone knows these days, it's great to allow your child to get this little sickness and that little sickness when they're very young. If you immunize them against everything, they don't build up their natural immunity. And if you protect your kid, from fights or from the pain of the classroom, of course they don't learn that sort of that little bit of toughness about how to deal with people in the world. And if you're too protective, you don't allow your kid to suffer a little bit. They're missing out on the important teachings of life. And that's exactly the same in sort of adult life as well. I've told many girls here, sometimes young girls come along here and they see me because they can't tell their parents, they trust me, because I've been here a long time. And they tell me about sort of some of their relationships, girls and boys, and just how sometimes devastated they are when one of those relationships just falls apart, especially their first love. And I just tell them many, many times, look, how can you know what love is until you've had a broken heart? Never felt that pain, when you sort of invested so much of your life in a partner and it's all fallen apart. Now, with that sort of pain, that suffering, now you're beginning to learn something about what love truly is. So, the broken hearts, the pain, the disappointments, that's almost like a rite of passage. The suffering in life is a rite of passage into wisdom and into compassion. When you see it that way, when people are suffering, we want to sort of be there for them. But look, I'm there to hold your hand, to be with you. It's your job to work that suffering out. And I'm not going to add to it. I'm not going to take it away from you either. Because that is actually robbing you of something really important. I'm going to ease it, especially the physical suffering, if at all possible. But the mental part of it, your relation, the reaction to it, this is something which we've all got to learn and know. As I said in the meditation, it's not the sort of the pain, the disappointment, the shame, or whatever else is the suffering each one of us feels from time to time in our life. It's what we do with it. It's our relationship, to having your, as I said last week, just about a year ago, last week or a couple of weeks ago, when we had the anniversary of the Bhikkhuni ordination. Now, I had my photos on the front pages of Bangkok newspapers saying what a bad guy I was. And so, who knows? What do you do with that? Okay, can't do anything, so don't worry about it. This is one of the sayings which I practice. If there's nothing you can do, do nothing. So why worry about it? So somebody else is worried, not mine. So, or you have great pains. You've got nothing to do. Do nothing. If there's something you can do about it, then now give it everything you've got. Try something. If there's nothing you can do, just relax and enjoy. I say enjoy on purpose. One of the key stories in that book, Open the Door of Your Heart, which, you know, I repeat these stories, but because they're worth repeating, is the story of the old soldier in the British Army during the Second World War in Japan. No, it wasn't Japan, so it was in Burma. And he was just an ordinary guy, had to join the army, and was actually at war, you know, firing real bullets and having real bullets fired at him. And he was on patrol in the jungles of Burma one day with about four or five other British soldiers. They had a scout, and the scout came back with bad news, really bad news. They had stumbled into a whole almost regiment of Japanese soldiers. They were completely surrounded, totally outnumbered, thousands of miles from his home, at war. What would you do? Ah, I'm going to die. In such situations, apparently, people who have been in the military have told me this, sometimes that the strong guys, the tough people, they just fall apart. And sometimes the little weaklings, you know, that these are the people who've suddenly become courageous. And this guy, he had courage. He said, let's try and fight our way out. Even though we're going to die, that's the manly thing to do. And who knows, one of us might make it. You never know. And anyway, if we all die, at least we take many of the enemy with us into death. Let's fight our way through against impossible odds. You know, just like you see on the movies. But I don't have this on the movies because it's not exciting. This is why. This is the trouble with Buddhism. Why we don't get so many people coming to our Buddhist communities in Australia, because it's just so peaceful. We don't have any violence in our religion. We just, you know, have ways of stopping the violence. So it's not an exciting religion. But anyway, his captain said, no, we will not try and fight our way out. Well, what should we do, sir? Instead, he said, we will all sit down and have a cup of tea. And that's what he said, in the middle of the jungle, in Burma, in the Second World War, surrounded by the enemy, totally outnumbered, and about to die. Let's have a cup of tea. That was the most crazy, mad, stupid thing the guy had ever heard, and thought, you know, somehow this commanding officer had had too much sun, had gone crazy, had gone mad. But orders were orders. Even though he thought this was totally stupid, they all sat down and made a cup of tea. In the time it took them to make the tea, the scout came back and whispered into the ear of the captain. The captain got all the soldiers together and told them, the enemy has moved. There's a gap. Pull your things away quickly. We'll crawl through. And every one of them escaped without any injury at all. And at that, the man who told me, a fellow teacher when I was a school teacher, said, that captain saved his life. Not just once, but many times. Because sometimes he had cancer, sometimes financial problems. It was like he was surrounded by the enemy, but not the Japanese, the ATO. That's the Australian Tax Office. Or sometimes the police, or sometimes who knows who's circling you. And sometimes he thought this was it. He was done for. What to do? But instead of trying to fight his way out, he would sit down and have a cup of tea. And things would change. And when things would change, when there was something he could do, then he had the energy and the effort to do that. And that story was just so Buddhist. When there's something you can do, do it. When there's nothing to do, just sit down and have a cup of tea. A cup of coffee if you like. I don't know what you like. But just don't do anything. Sit still for a while. And it will save your life. So sometimes when somebody is suffering like that, and it's your son, it's your daughter, it's your wife, husband, father, your loved one, what should you do? If it's something to do, then do it. If not, sit down and have a cup of tea. That is wise. It means you're not adding to the problems. It means the suffering of one person is not becoming madness and craziness with anyone else around you. That is like real love combined with wisdom. And you will find that situations do change. Diseases sort of, sometimes they're here, sometimes they go. Financial situations change. Who knows what's going to happen next? That's always my sort of understanding of life. Life is just a progression of the unexpected. I never know what I'm going to do next. I will keep telling you that, you know, I always like telling our Vice President Ming about my sort of movements, because I have to look at the internet site myself. Where is Ajahn Brahm to find out what I'm supposed to do today? So sometimes I have to ask other people, because I forget what I'm supposed to be doing. So, because you live in the present moment, you just, you know, just day by day, moment by moment, and just let it happen. Because sometimes things go wrong. Sometimes people told me there was an aircraft crash of Qantas or something. So, you know, if you go overseas, you don't know whether you're going to make it there. So who knows anyway what's going to happen next. So when I look like that, you'd let just, when there's nothing to do, just leave it alone. Things will change, as they always do. Something to do, then do something. So you don't allow yourself to suffer when someone else is suffering. You try to control situations which are totally beyond your control. That's why Buddhists are not control freaks. I never tell you what to do. I never shout at you when you don't do it, because they never tell you what to do anyway. We sort of, you know, give you that freedom, that trust. You know, so if you want the five precepts, keep them. If you don't want them, it's up to you. You still be my friend, and I will never judge you for not keeping those. And that sort of type of like love, to open the door for my heart no matter what you do and how you behave, is a beautiful way of saying I don't own you. You know, I won't control you. Now, if you do the same with the people you love, it's amazing what happens. It means that when they are suffering, at least they know that you're not controlling them, but you will always be there for them, which means that they feel this beautiful sense of freedom and acceptance. If they make a mess, if they succeed, you'll love them both ways. So the idea of like fear, they have to get it right. The idea of them being ashamed when they're suffering disappears. I know that many, many times people are ashamed when they suffer, as if, you know, they've done something wrong and they deserve to suffer. If you get sick, oh my goodness, I wasn't looking after my health. And if you get sort of cancer, oh my goodness, I wasn't meditating enough. I wasn't maybe eating the right food, because I get heart disease. There's a lot of guilt, which is accompanied with disease. So if you are sick, please, please, just be sick and don't feel guilty about it. You're allowed to be sick. It's not against the law in Australia. It's not against the five precepts. We should start a campaign for sick people's rights. I demand my right to be sick, if you want to be. In other words, don't feel guilty about it. I know I've told this story before again, but it's a great one. Has there anybody in this room this evening who's never been sick in their life? If there is, please put your hand up. Is anyone here who's never been sick? So I can assume, there's no one's hands up, that each one of you has been sick from time to time in your life. In fact, if you'd never been sick, it would be very weird. You'd be such an anomaly that, you know, the hospitals would be actually doing all sorts of tests on you. How come you've never been sick in your life? So it'd actually be weird if you were not sick. In fact, it'd be very wrong. Something wrong with you if you never get sick. By which I mean, it's right to be sick. So I always tell people, when you go to the doctor with the flu, with the sickness, with the cancer, whatever, please tell that doctor, "Doctor, there's something right with me. I'm sick again." And I like saying that, because that takes away the guilt. You say, "There's something wrong with me. I'm sick again." And therefore you feel guilt, you feel like a failure, you haven't been looking after your health. I remember a time I had a bad back because I was working too hard building Serpentine Monastery in the early days. And I know exactly what I did there. I was laying some concrete under the wall. The concrete was going off, going hard too quickly, and I had to work like a slave to make sure it was all level before it got too hard to work anymore. So I was bent over in the trench working too hard. I knew I was going to do something wrong, but I sacrificed myself for the Buddhist society. That was okay, because I knew it was all going to be all right in the end. So I got this really bad back. I remember going to the doctors, you know, to get it checked out, and there I was sitting in the doctors with a bad back. And this friend I knew, it's actually from the local prison, he looked at me and was sitting in the doctor's surgery, and he said, "I never expected to see you in here." As if I was in a pub or in a brothel or something. The doctor's surgery. He said, "But I expect you to be healthy. You're monks. You live a nice, peaceful, stressful lifestyle." And I felt guilty. I felt ashamed of being in a doctor's surgery and being sick when I teach other people how to live a healthy lifestyle. But now it's okay for monks to be sick. So take away the guilt, the shame of being sick. So when someone else is sick, nothing wrong with that. So when someone else is suffering with a sickness, physical suffering, but don't make mental suffering out of it. Some people keep telling me when they're very, very sick, "Oh, but I'm such a great burden on everybody else. You know, they have to wipe my bum, they have to feed me, they have to do all this stuff for me." What a great practice of humility it is to be sick. You can't do anything for yourself, so don't try to do anything for yourself. Don't we believe in karma? When you're sick, you're giving other people this wonderful opportunity to care for you. So care for me, husband. I'm sick. Breakfast in bed, foot massage, you know, washing me or whatever. What a wonderful thing. And you know, it's actually great fun to look after somebody who's sick. To try and, it is, I try and turn them on and look after them and care for them. You get a lot of joy out of caring for people. So, if I'm sick, this is my opportunity, when I'm sick, to give all of you the opportunity to care and to make good karma. So next time you're sick and you have to stay home, whoever's caring for you, say, "This is your opportunity to make some good karma by looking after me." And if you look at it that way, it's actually quite beautiful, beautiful. And that means you're not ashamed, you don't mind other people looking after you, you don't say, "Oh no, 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 I'll do it myself." No, let them do it for you. Even if you can do it better, in Buddhism we're always taught, even if you can do it better, it doesn't matter, you let them do it for you, because they need to make some good karma. We need to to express our love towards one another. If I'm so independent, I never let you do anything for me at all, then we don't have any love, we don't have any sort of connection. That is, you know, one of the reasons why, that even though that I can cook for myself, I could go to the grocery shop if I wanted to, and put it on the account of the Buddhist Society, but we don't do that because we want you to feed us. Even though we can feed ourselves very well, thank you, we want you to feed us. Why is that? Because that gives us a beautiful connection. So monks are just like, monks and nuns are just like these hopeless beings. Just, if it wasn't for you, I'd be hungry. So just feed me. Clothe me. Give me robes. Give me slippers. Give me toothpaste. It's such a nice thing to do, isn't it? So it's wonderful we do things like that. Because what that means, even if you don't need them, look, as Lakshmi's over there. I've named you now, Lakshmi. She was a lady many, many years ago. She was sitting over there. And just before the Friday night talk, she gave me a pair of socks. I never wear socks. Very, 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 very rarely. But she gave me some socks. She knitted them herself. So I put them on for the Friday night talk. And during the Friday night talk, you know, I'm getting old. You have to move every now and again. And I was moving and I just put a foot out with the sock on. And I remember you, Lakshmi, you said, "He's wearing my socks, he's wearing my socks." You do that. Why do you do that? Because someone's been kind to you. Even if I don't need the socks, I'm going to wear them just because I make somebody happy. And I get happy seeing somebody else is happy. And I tell the story and everyone gets happy. So if someone is really sick, Wonderful, they can look after you. So when someone else is suffering, see if you can make some fun out of it, some joy out of it. It's a wonderful opportunity to care for one another, to serve for one another. But obviously, for that sort of serving together, you need someone to be sick, first of all, someone to be suffering. So when that person is suffering, you look upon it as giving this great opportunity for other people to care and help for you. Yeah, it's humbling, yeah, it's humiliating, yeah, you know, you like to do things yourself, but it's a wonderful. People who are your friends really come out and they look after you. That's one of the most beautiful things about sickness and suffering in life. You know, you lose your money, other people come out and help you. It's a beautiful thing to see that. A community helping one another. You know that sometimes that people used to say that, I was born in London, and people used to say they have these old like blocks of apartments, were hotbeds of crime. There were sink estates, I think they call them these days. And it wasn't really a sink estate, but close. It was a block of apartments which was sponsored by the government, so it was really low rent. And that's where, you know, I grew up. And I remember going visiting my mother there once, and I was staying a few days. And one afternoon evening, I was going to give a talk at the local Sri Lankan temple. And it was about an hour's walk away, and I needed the exercise, so I decided to walk to the temple to give the talk. And as I went from my mother's apartment on the 14th floor in the lift, when it got to the ground floor, and you know, the lift doors opened, in front of me was an elderly woman covered in blood. Poor lady. I didn't know what had happened to her. She'd fallen down the concrete stairs. So forget the talk. So come up, we'll just look after you. So I brought her into the lift, looked after her, and brought her into my mother's apartment. My mother's no good with blood. You know, she just said, well, you look after it. So we got a sponge out, and she called the ambulance. And you know, it takes a while for an ambulance to come. We're just cleaning her up and just, you know, looking after her, just giving her a bit of kindness and reassuring her. But what was really nice was, you know, left the door of my mother's apartment open. It was like a trail of blood going into my mother's apartment. And all these people started coming in. Are you okay? Everything okay? And there was some suffering there. But all these people in this apartment block all came into my mother's house to give a hand. This poor old lady had left something on in the oven, cooking for the dinner's meal. They got the key and turned the gas off. They rang her sister up, her daughter up or something, who was a nurse, and they arranged everything, and the ambulance came and took her. She had a broken leg, but she managed to stand up. I don't know how she managed to do that. Cleaned her up. She was just a bit shaken, that's all. But what I really liked was when they were suffering, how much it brought that community together. Because there is always that golden lining in suffering. So if someone you loved is suffering, it's not just bad, bad, bad. That suffering has a beautiful sense of giving us an opportunity to care, giving us an opportunity to show how much we look after one another, serve one another, and are kind to one another. And so there's always something beautiful in suffering when people come along and help out. So if someone is suffering in your family, someone you do love, it's also an opportunity there to show these beautiful parts of human nature. And of course that suffering does pass. It doesn't last for too long. So if that someone you love is suffering, number one, they're getting a lot of growth out of this. It's tough for them, but we have to go through these things where we grow our wisdom and compassion. We learn about life. So, you know, it is an opportunity. And it's also an opportunity for everyone else around to show how much they care and what a beautiful sense of community and love this truly is. So it's actually not controlling this and saying, get out of the suffering as quickly as you can. It's a sense of understanding, accepting it's part of life. Opening the door of your heart to the existence of suffering. Seeing a beautiful part, which happens always when there is suffering. And also a wonderful way where we can all grow and show some of the most beautiful parts of human life when there is some suffering in our community. So when someone is suffering in your community, it doesn't have to create even more bad mental states with everybody around. I know that sometimes they say, why did it happen to them? Please, in Buddhism, no guilt, no punishment. He doesn't know why these things happen. Stop looking for, you know, the causes. Now, was it because they didn't look after themselves or because they cheated? Is it the result of bad karma from the past? Who knows what happens? why it happens. So when anybody ever suffers in Buddhism, it's not why did this happen to me, why did it happen to them? It's what are we doing about it right now? There is that old story in Buddhism about the person shot by an arrow. This is in the time of the Buddha. And when the person was shot by an arrow, he started asking, well, who shot me with an arrow? What type of arrow it was? Where did the guy come from? How many kids did he have? That's a stupid question. Someone shot you with an arrow. Just go and call the doctor. Get the arrow out. So instead of saying, why, where did this come from? Why me? Why did this happen to me? Why was this suffering happen? Why did I get cancer? Why did this person cheat me? Why did this person die? What are we doing about it? And that becomes a very, very proactive aspect of Buddhist psychology in dealing with suffering. We don't say why and try and find someone to blame. It's always about, here we are, now how are we going to move forward from here? What are we doing about it? And if you find that you take away this blame, this anger, this trying to find something to blame or some mistake which somebody made or you made, when we stop wasting time doing that, it's amazing just how much opportunity we have to look at this problem and actually deal with it and make something beautiful out of it. Look about this story which I heard last week. There was a guy who was actually went to a marriage counselor because he was having trouble with his relationship with his wife. And basically the marriage counselor said, well look, you know, it's a husband and wife, you know, you have to do something to attract her. So a few days later, he was found in front of his Massey Ferguson, because he was a farmer, naked, doing a sexy dance. Because he was told to do something sexy to attract her. That's today's joke. Come on. You're shaking your head. Are you suffering? But. So whenever there's any suffering with someone you love, these are good attitudes which we can do. What are we doing about it? It's an opportunity. It's some suffering there, but you don't have to have the mental suffering. The mental suffering is, I don't want this to happen. Why me? It shouldn't happen. You can always do something about it, and you can make it a beautiful experience, no matter what it happens to be. And with that Buddhist attitude, you find that the suffering in life, yeah, it's still there. It's still so painful, but we don't tend to moan so much or get so angry and upset. And it's a beautiful thing to be able to see that. Another example which comes to mind of one of the old disciples of this center over here. I remember she was one of the early disciples who used to come and help at our monastery in Serpentine. She got lung cancer. And you know, she was such a tough lady. She thought it was actually hay fever. She couldn't breathe very well. But eventually she went to the doctor and they found it was lung cancer. I remember going to see her at Charlie Gardner's Hospital because she called and said, doctor has just told me it is lung cancer and there's nothing they can do about it. It's terminal. So I always remember that situation. I came to see her, rushed to see her, and went into the sort of the room. And there she was in her bed, laughing, wheezing a bit, but laughing and just, you know, we discussed the funeral arrangements. You know, she had four beautiful kids. And I think the youngest, you know, Joseph, is about 9 years of age or 8 years of age or something. It was beautiful just the way that she was totally at ease and at peace, you know, with the fact that she was going to die in, you know, 2 or 3 months. It was very impressive because she was a real Buddhist. Instead of being physical suffering, you don't have to make mental suffering out of it. You can't do anything about it. So if you can't do anything about it, what should you do? Have a cup of tea. And that's what she did. But what was really interesting, after we made all the arrangements for the funeral and looking after her kids and everything, then I was walking out of the hospital and this very elderly nurse said, have you just been to see that woman? I said, yes. Wonderful. Can you please come in here because I'm very concerned about her. And it was actually the matron of the hospital, the head nurse. I said, well, what's wrong? She said, she's in denial. She doesn't realize she's dying. And I said, she's just spent the last hour planning the funeral with me. And this nurse says, well, why isn't she crying and moaning and getting angry and upset? And I said, because she's a Buddhist. That was actually quite fascinating for me, because that was one of the first times where I saw just how beautifully Buddhists die. And it was just so uncommon that this matron who had been in the system for such a long time, it was the first time they saw anything like that. So when a loved one is really suffering, you can actually make a great example for others. Because if I'm suffering, and you suffer as well, when you come and visit me, that makes both of us suffer. And just, that really messes up the whole sort of dying process. Look, there's one time when I went over to the old hospice over in Shenton Park, you know, the old hospice, they used to work there. And because there was a nun there, a Buddhist nun, who was dying of cancer. She was a Tibetan nun, I was a sort of Theravada nun, but we don't care about those things, you know. A nun is a nun is a nun to me. Don't care where they come from. So anyway, I went up to see her. She spent some time in our monastery when she had cancer. And that, so she was at the end of her journey. And so she rang me up down at Serpentine. Ajahn Brahm, can you come and see me? Because I think I'm dying. I'm going to go soon. And you know how busy I am. You know, I've got to go to all these things and chanting and blessings and all this sort of stuff. And she says, oh, of course. And so she dropped everything. And just, you know, got in the car from Serpentine and just went all the way to Shenton Park for the hospice there. But, you know, the rules are the rules. You had to check in first of all. You can't just barge into a dying person's room because who knows what procedures are going on in there. So I checked in with the nurse. I've come to see sort of this nurse, nun called so-and-so. And the nurse looked in the book and said, I'm sorry, but she's given explicit instructions that she doesn't want any visitors. I said, but she just called me about an hour ago and asked me to come. Look, we must respect the patient's wishes. But look, I've come all the way from Serpentine an hour just for her. And that nurse got very angry at me. She said, come over here. So I followed her and she went to this patient's room. And on the room was a big piece of paper saying, absolutely no visitors, it said. And the nurse said, see? I had a look, but actually underneath in small print were the words, except Ajahn Brahm. And I looked at that nurse and said, see? I enjoyed that. It's her karma, she's getting angry, doesn't trust a monk. So, of course, I went in there. But, of course, the first thing I said is, why did you actually write that on your door? Now, why did you give an exception to me? No visitors except for Ajahn Brahm. And she said, look, I'm dying. I'm suffering. And you're the only person who comes in here and who doesn't suffer seeing me like this. Instead, you smile, you tell me jokes, and you say, we talk about death. Everyone else who comes in here, I'm suffering. And they get emotional, they start crying, and just imagine how that makes me feel. I've got my own suffering to bear with, and now you guys, other guys except for you, come in here and you make me suffer worse. And I thought that was a wonderful thing she said to me, and I say that to you as well. Imagine someone suffering or dying, and you get emotional too. You're not taking away their suffering, you're not helping them at all, you're adding to the pain. What a wonderful thing it is when someone is suffering. You can be at peace and bring them more peace. You can lessen their suffering that way. That's how to deal with someone who you love, who is suffering. Tell them a joke. Tell them about the person doing a sexy dance in front of a tractor. Or whatever it is, so that you can lessen their suffering. So this is actually how we can deal with a loved one who is suffering. Now we don't need to suffer with them. That's not empathy. That's controlling. That's reacting in an unhelpful way. First of all, we have to allow each other to suffer. Open the door of your heart to the other person, no matter what they're doing. It's a tough one, but we have to do that. And when they are suffering, I understand it's a beautiful opportunity to help, to serve, to look after. And also to realize that it does pass. If there's something to do, do something. If there's nothing to do, do nothing. Things change. Wait for the opportunities to do something beautiful and useful. But even just being there. But when they're crying, don't go crying back. When they're screaming, don't scream back. When they're hurting, give them peace. That's real love. Attachment, control, is when I can't do anything. I must do something, and you get frantic. So often in life, there's nothing one can do except to be peaceful, to smile, to love. That's always something you can do. And if you can do that, you know how to deal with a loved one who is suffering. And that's the talk for tonight. Okay, is there any questions about this evening's talk? Or comments? Hopefully it's useful for you, because we're all going to come across that sooner or later. Yes. Yeah. the secret plan of the end of the universe with the Buddhist mind. Now look, that's one of the things you're asking about, what's happening with the planet. Is there some sort of long-term plan? A lot of people are losing hope. There's so much negativity, especially in some religions. They always think the end of the world is coming. There's going to be some Armageddon. And that idea of an end of the world, it really sort of excites people. And it's almost because they think like that, you know, that maybe the world will end if they really want it to. I can't hear. Yes, indeed. It is not, no, this, but yeah, that type of end of the world, again, sometimes what it does, it draws that negativity of our sort of communities. It does, yeah. So instead with Buddhism, one of the reasons I love it is because it always has hope. There's always something we can do with what we've got. And it's that sort of, you know, that ingenuity. It doesn't mean that we're being heedless. It means we're being very active instead of sort of just waiting for things to sort of fall apart. That's not the law of karma. Just that's my karma. It's the karma of the world to end. No, no, no. We make karma every moment. And there's no sort of almost hardly any limitations on what we can achieve and what we can do. So if humanity has had its back against the wall many times, then if we really work together, we can pull through. And who knows that sometimes some of the disasters which happen in the world, they are wake-up calls. And they do create a greater sense of harmony working together in our communities. Whenever there's any war, it's the one time when the political parties all join together and they do have a unity government. And not when there's sort of a tied parliament, but when there's a common enemy, a tragedy coming, that's when we do find some unity at last. It's a shame we have to wait till then to be able to work together. And I have this great sense of hope for our humanity. We're always learning, we're always growing, and yes, some bad things happening, for some beautiful things happening as well. It's been religion. I mean, so many religious people, leaders are coming together and talking to each other and getting some peace and harmony between our religions instead of fighting. Again, like Europe, where I grew up in, you know, so the boundaries are coming down between these nations which used to go to war for centuries. I still remember reading in history about the 100 Years' War between England and France. 100 years of war. And now there's no way that England and France will go to war anymore. Except maybe over a soccer match, you know, if a goal was disallowed. But you know, there is actually a change which you see. And so there's always a good change. I like to focus on that and not on the negativity. Because if you focus on the negativity, people give up hope. They just become selfish. So let's look upon sort of something positive. And if we could only all understand reincarnation, it would be a wonderful thing. If all of the leaders of the world, whenever they go to the climate conference, they realize that they are going to come back as kids on this earth. Now, they're not going to escape global warming. Because most of the guys who make all these decisions are in their 70s and 80s, or at least, you know, mid-60s. They think, you know, they're going to be out of here by the time the events happen. But they realize they're going to have to live in this earth again. Then we'll take much better care of our planet. Death is no escape from birth. You're going to come back here. Many, many lives you've got to live on this planet. So better look after it. Don't trash your house. You're going to kind of have to live in it again tomorrow. I like that idea. So we get that idea more. There's more reason why our elderly leaders can actually be a bit more caring about the environment. And number two, what Buddhism was really good at is one of the biggest problems of our planet, which everybody knows but not enough people talk about. There's too many people on this planet. Just no matter what else you do, too many people, too many kids. So listen, we need more monks, more nuns, celibacy. So if you want to do something for the planet, ordain. So at least we're very green. We don't have kids. If you're thinking of having a kid, have a dog or a cat or something. You know, they cost much less money and they're far more cuddly and they don't talk back. Okay, anyway, so thank you for that.